World Service of the BBC, this is Clive Marden with NewsHour. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, with Russian forces continuing to pound the Chechen capital Grozny, a military spokesman says the rebels are turning the city and other rebel strongholds into impregnable fortresses, which would mean heavy Russian losses if they tried to enter. Yet another flashpoint in Indonesia, at least 30 people killed in renewed fighting between Christians and Muslims in the eastern Moluccan Islands. NASA waits to hear from its missing Mars lander. How long before they have to admit they've lost it? And the new SkyTrain, which the Thai authorities are hoping will put an end to the daily traffic snarl-ups in Bangkok. First, the news in detail. It's read by Nicola Davis.
BBC World Service. The man who's to take over as head of the World Trade Organization Supachai Panichapak of Thailand has said that the failure of the WTO talks in Seattle shows that developing countries are making their voice heard against the demands of the rich nations. Mr. Supachai, who is currently Thailand's commerce minister, said any agreement in future must benefit all, and he hoped that renewed attempts in Geneva next year would decide the key issues. Charlotte Bevan reports.
Supachai Panichapak said that the failure of the talks to produce any agreements was tantamount to a wake-up call for rich countries to make sure that the interests of developing nations are taken into account when it comes to a new round of talks. The meeting had ended in failure, he said, but this should be seen positively as a sign that developing countries are now better prepared for the meeting. They're getting their views across and they're proving tougher to bargain with. One of the major sticking points during this latest round was the proposal from America that issues such as child labor should be linked to trade sanctions. Developing nations feel such a move will undermine their competitive edge in providing cheap labor. Mr. Supachai said it wasn't surprising the talks had failed, since there was disagreement over practically every page of the statement prepared before the meeting, and 5 days wasn't enough time to sort out key issues.
The authorities in the Moluccan Islands of Indonesia say at least 31 people have been killed in one of the worst single clashes in the year-long conflict between Muslims and Christians. Police said the violence started on Friday when Muslims attacked a Christian village on Seram Island. More than 500 people have died in the clashes between Muslims and Christians who've lived for centuries side by side. In a further sign of thawing relations between North Korea and the United States, President Clinton's half-brother Roger has performed with his jazz band at a concert in the North Korean capital Pyongyang. North Korean media said that on Saturday, Roger Clinton saw the chairman of the committee which sponsored the concert, Kim Jong-sun. He is also secretary of North Korea's ruling Korean Workers' Party, and correspondents say he's a confidant of the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-il. The authorities in Iran say the former government minister, Abdullah Nouri, who was jailed last month for 5 years for spreading anti-Islamic propaganda, has lost his right to appeal. The judge of the special religious court that handed down the sentence said as Mr. Nouri had chosen not to appeal after the sentence was passed, he must serve his term. He also said colleagues of Mr. Nouri might face legal proceedings for writing the articles that led to his conviction. During his trial, Mr. Nouri, who is one of the closest associates of President Khatami, said that as he did not recognize the legality of his sentence, he was not going to appeal. His supporters say he is the victim of a campaign by conservatives to prevent reformists from contesting parliamentary elections next year. United Nations officials say a convoy of more than 100 lorries loaded with food for famine relief is stranded by floods 200 kilometers south of Mogadishu. The convoy, organized by the World Food Programme, left Mogadishu 10 days ago for the Bay and Bakol regions. It was being escorted by a number of armored vehicles. Drivers reported by radio that roads had been washed away and attempts to find an alternative route had failed. American scientists have again failed to establish contact with the Polar Lander spacecraft, which should have reported back from Mars. After 3 attempts yesterday, they now say they are less confident of receiving a signal from the craft, heightening concern that the multi-million dollar mission may have ended in failure. There's still another chance, several hours from now, when the craft is programmed to send back a signal to Earth. Leo Enright has been following events from Mission Control at Pasadena in California.
Flight controllers here are disheartened, but not despairing. All may now hinge on a single 10-minute communication session just before 7 o'clock GMT on Sunday night. At that time, a relay satellite in Mars orbit will rise into the sky above the Martian Antarctic, passing almost directly over the supposed landing site of the missing robot explorer. It will be the middle of the night on Mars, and the polar lander itself will have been asleep, as it were, conserving its batteries. But it's been programmed to wake up at 10 to 7 and communicate with controllers through this orbiting telephone exchange. This has not been tried before, and it may be the lander's final hope.
The city of Bangkok has inaugurated a futuristic new system to help ease its notorious traffic jams. It's called the SkyTrain, an elevated electric railway that runs through some of the most congested parts of the Thai capital. The system cost $1.5 billion to build and cuts across on a viaduct. BBC World Service.
You're listening to NewsHour. I'm Clive Marden. Today, a Russian military spokesman would appear to have confirmed what most observers of the conflict in Chechnya have known all along, that they're none too keen on sending soldiers into the capital, Grozny, and the other remaining rebel strongholds, because that would inevitably mean heavy Russian losses. Well, the Russian spokesman, Gennady Alyokhin, was talking about the rebels taking measures to turn Grozny and the town of Urus-Martan into impregnable strongholds. On the line now is our Moscow correspondent Paul Anderson. Paul, I take it from all this that we can conclude that the tactic of bombing and of shelling from a distance is going to go on then.
It very much looks that way, and as heavily as the Russians have conducted this tactic in the past, today we've learned that Russian fighter planes have carried out sorties over Grozny, dropping bombs on the center of Grozny and on the outskirts of the capital. Also fairly heavy shelling going on just to the southwest to the rebel stronghold of Urus-Martan. The Russians have met little resistance so far in their campaign across Chechnya, but there are signs that the Chechens are beginning to concentrate their efforts. The Russians know that there are about 5,000 rebels, or say at least that there are about 5,000 rebels waiting for them in Grozny, and that there are several thousand more in Urus-Martan, and they will be unwilling to jump into a confrontation on the ground with those rebels and will continue to try to pound them into submission.
Well, that's it, Paul, isn't it? You specifically say the Russians say there are these thousands of rebels still in Grozny, in Urus-Martan, obviously some still left, but clearly large numbers will already have slipped out to the mountains to the south. Clearly they'd like to shift the war to a terrain sort of more favourable for them. Moscow presumably not going to fall for that.
Moscow, I don't think, will want to fall for that. Although the rebels, it's unclear exactly how many rebels are in Grozny at the moment, but Grozny is obviously the big prize for the Russians and a city that the rebels will want to hold on to. So I think it's credible that there are still a number of rebels in Grozny and that they will be looking to confront the Russians once the Russians have surrounded, if they manage to do it, surrounded the capital and move into the capital to take it completely. But as of Friday last week, we had indications that the Russians had nearly completed their encirclement of Grozny, and at that point the rebel leadership was saying, we are now going to concentrate our fight against the Russians on one or two places near Grozny and also in the mountain areas. And I think the Russians will be very, very wary indeed, although they are committed to it long term, very wary indeed of moving south into the mountain area and taking on the Chechen rebels.
All right, Paul, thanks very much indeed. Paul Anderson, live from Moscow. So what about the long-suffering people of Chechnya? Is independence from Russia so high on their list of priorities? How are they going to survive the winter? Do they care who holds Grozny, as long as they're not bombarded day and night? Austrian journalist Thomas Seifert spent several weeks in Chechnya, based near the capital Grozny. He's now back in Vienna.
I was in Ingushetia a few weeks ago, and the refugees who left, they told me that in fact they were fed up with the conflict and they were fed up with the war. It doesn't make a difference for them whether it's President Yeltsin or President Maskhadov, and that's why they left. They just had enough of it. And the situation is a little bit different with the people who decided to stay in Chechnya that I met in Grozny, in and around Grozny. And they said, well, that they will stay and they are loyal to President Maskhadov and they are loyal to the Chechen cause. So I think maybe that was also one of the strategies of the Russians to drive as many people out of the country as possible. And now you have a fraction of the people still in Chechnya, but they seem willing to stay there and to remain loyal to the Chechen government.
Do you get a sense that President Maskhadov, the fighters around him, have a time scale in mind, or are they sort of saying, we can hang on indefinitely, you can stay outside the city as long as you want, but you ain't coming in?
Yes, I heard that. I talked to one of the sector commanders with the name Said Hussein, and he told me that he doesn't think that the Russians dare to go in to Grozny, because in the last Chechen war they suffered heavy losses when they were fighting in the urban area. So basically there is only now one single route from the south to Grozny open, and the Russians are pressing hard towards Uruzmartan. That's another rebel stronghold where there's heavy fighting. And another rebel stronghold is Shali in the south. The Russians are really trying to close down the route to the south.
That was Austrian journalist Thomas Seifert. Well, the tiny Republic of Ingushetia has, of course, taken the full force of the humanitarian crisis in Chechnya, caught as it is right in the middle between Moscow on the one side and Chechnya on the other, and leaving its leader in a very isolated position. Tom Duval now reports on the situation in Ingushetia.
There's only one road out of the war zone of Chechnya, and this is its final stop. Just past the first roadblock inside Ingushetia, a bus unloads a cargo of women and children fleeing the fighting. The influx of refugees here has been so great that in the last 3 months, the population of this tiny Russian republic has almost doubled. Ingushetia's president, Ruslan Alshev, is the only leader in the region who's taking in Chechen refugees. A former veteran of the Afghan war, who still wears camouflage fatigues in his office, he can hardly be accused of being an enemy of Russia. But he's also the strongest critic of the latest Chechen war.
Другими словами, все, что сейчас делается, делается, я считаю, что неправильно и недальновидно.
What they are doing now is wrong and short-sighted. This problem will continue to exist. Maybe for a year or two it will look good for the political elite. They can say, we solved the Chechen question. But in actual fact, they will have solved nothing. Now on the territory of Ingushetia, there are more than 200,000 refugees. At the beginning, these people were unhappy with those who brought about the war and the Russian invasion. Now, all their anger is directed towards the regime in Moscow.
Ingushetia is tied to Chechnya by common history and kinship. The two peoples are closely related and speak almost the same language. In 1944, they were both deported to Central Asia by Stalin. But while the Chechens are more mountain people with a rebellious streak, the Ingush are people of the plains, who've always had to get on better with the Russians. Having Chechnya as a neighbor has been a disaster, however. The last 5 years saw a war and then a period of anarchy and kidnapping. All potential investors remember the case of the four Western telephone engineers who were kidnapped and then beheaded. Mustafa Abiev is an English government official.
Of course it's a difficult period for Ingushetia because we haven't any infrastructure and now we are waiting for investments. And when we have that kind of a neighbor, it's very difficult to get them. Less than 1 year ago, we had some negotiations with some particular about some renovation of telephone system in the Ingushetia. And the first of all, what they showed to us, it was heads. And I said, of course, it's happened in Chechnya, not in Ingushetia, but I said, you know, it's almost the same one because you're a close neighbor.
Now the latest war is putting enormous strain once again on Ingushetia. In Moscow, there's a suspicion that although the generals were prepared for this war, the politicians had not thought through what would be the consequences for this unstable region.
It seems to me that Russia, till now, it has no political program. It has no politics, a real politics in Northern Caucasus.
Professor Alexei Malashenko is a specialist on the Caucasus. He believes there will come a moment when the president of Ingushetia may be called upon to play a mediator's role, as he did during the last conflict.
I would be against if somebody in Moscow, if somebody in administration wants to push Auschwitz from this process. I think that actually Northern Caucasus, Moscow administration badly need such kind of general, of post-Soviet general, who understands the situation very well and who is turned at the same time to both sides, who is able to talk with Moscow and at the same time he's able to invite and to be invited by Maschadov. It seems to me that he may play the role of key figures, key personality among other Caucasian leaders.
An armored car rumbles up to the Chechen border. The war in Chechnya is escalating. Mr. Aushev complains that no one in Moscow wants to negotiate with the Chechens, so his main concern is looking after an ever-growing tide of refugees from the war zone and wondering how Ingushetia will get through the winter.
Tom Duval reporting. And coming up in the next 15 minutes, where is our lander? NASA scratches its head over its missing Mars probe. And desperate measures in Cambodia to tackle a serious shortage of blood. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Clive Marden with NewsHour. Brief reminder of our main stories. Following the collapse of the Seattle World Trade Talks, the world's richer nations have been warned that concerns of developing countries must be given much more consideration in the future. And at least 30 people are reported dead in an upsurge of fighting between Christians and Muslims in Indonesia. Now, Angola is well known as one of the very poorest countries in the world. The long-running and devastating war and natural disasters mean the nation's people are some of the most deprived anywhere. And yet, the country is rich in natural resources, in minerals, and especially oil. When I say the people are poor, it would be more accurate to say perhaps most of the people are poor. Some, the political elite, have become super rich, siphoning off the financial profits from oil revenue. And a lot of that money inevitably goes into funding the government's war against the UNITA rebels. Well, now a campaign has been launched by the British pressure group Global Witness to try to stop all that and to make sure the money goes where it's needed. Simon Taylor is a director of Global Witness.
We're looking at three main areas. The first one is the issue of corruption itself. We have named a series of people who we've called the untouchable oligarchy. And these are people who we see as having been principally involved in the siphoning off of revenue from overinflated invoices and so on. And we're saying that this is a country that could be one of the richest in Africa, and yet, short ago as in October, people not far from the capital were facing starvation conditions. The other area, I think, that's very important is the role of the big multinational corporations as well. Principally, of course, the oil companies, and they stand sort of afar and sort of make comments like, we're not involved in the politics of the country, and so on, and we're challenging them on the basis that actually, you know, as the main source of revenue, they are already, by default, involved in the politics of the country, and there's a duty upon them to become more transparent in the amounts that they pay, and so on. Because
what specifically are you proposing?
We're proposing that they open up their payments to the full light of day, to a greater level of transparency than that which they would normally be expected to produce outside in Western countries. And the reason for that is that it is almost impossible to ascertain how much money is actually being made.
Give me a sort of idea of the sort of scale of oil revenue or potential oil revenue Angola has. We've got an idea of the sort of sums we're talking about.
We've done some calculations and we reckon somewhere between just under $1 billion in 1995 to up to $2.7 billion, I think, in 97 was brought into the government, somewhere around that. But that's been unbelievably difficult to work out. And if you're the average Angolan, for which, you know, this is Angola's and the Angolan people's natural resources and as enshrined in their constitution, it's almost impossible for Angolans to work out how much money is being made. So on the one hand, there is no transparency in Angola about how much state revenue is being generated, and then on the other side, because this money is disappearing, there's no transparency about where it's going. And so what we're calling for is the oil companies in particular to start to increase these levels of transparency.
Can you see the oil companies playing along with this, a sort of new ethical era?
Well, many of them, particularly BP, have made incredible statements about their ethical behaviour and so on. So I think, you know, we're calling, I suppose, principally in the first place, BP to live up to some of those claims.
Simon Taylor of the British pressure group Global Witness. Now, some news just to hand. The IRA has said it has begun talks on giving up its weapons as part of the Northern Ireland peace process. It said a meeting had taken place between its representative and the commission which is overseeing the dismantling of paramilitary arsenals. The IRA said further talks would take place. We'll have more on that story a little later on in the programme. Now, disheartened, but not despairing, at least not yet. That would seem to be the current position of the American space agency, NASA, as the hours tick by and they still haven't been able to make contact with the errant $165 million Mars Polar Lander, which should have been beaming up signals from the surface of the Red Planet, where it was supposed to have touched down. How long are they going to give it before they give up and admit that it's lost? Before we came on air, I spoke to NASA Mission Control in Pasadena and their spokeswoman, Diane Ainsworth.
It's going to be quite a while before we actually exhaust all of our options. The flight team has quite a number of options to exercise in the next several days, certainly, and after that, then I think they will perhaps try to carry out some longer-term options.
So days we're talking about rather than hours. What are the theories that you're working on so far? What might have happened, and what are you actually trying to do to retrieve the situation?
Well, we were thinking that the spacecraft might have gone into a safety mode right after it landed, and in that event, it would not communicate with us. It's automatically programmed to shut down and go to sleep and recharge its batteries. I think that we had expected to perhaps hear it automatically turn on and communicate with us if that had been the case. And we had a communications pass late Saturday evening in which we did not hear from the spacecraft. So we're moving on to the next possibility, being that perhaps the spacecraft is not oriented in the correct position. In other words, its antenna is not pointing in the right direction. So we're going to try some communications passes later today using the spacecraft's medium gain antenna and to see if we might be able to pick up a signal.
And that was NASA's Diane Ainsworth speaking from Mission Control in Pasadena. Now, a campaign has been launched in Cambodia urging volunteers to donate blood to combat a national shortage of blood supplies. The shortage is made worse by the fact that about a fifth of the blood which is donated is found to be infected, either with the HIV virus or with hepatitis B and C, syphilis, or malaria. The situation is so desperate that hospital staff have been sent to pagodas in the belief that if anyone's likely to have clean blood, it'll be the monks. Well, others have tried to take advantage of the situation. A growing market of professional blood sellers has been the result. Caroline Gluck reports from Phnom Penh.
This is a stock of units already tested, and this is actually what we have to respond to a need. Right now, I don't know, maybe around 20. Some are already booked for patients. When there is elective surgery, we can prepare units of blood for patients who are according to the needs, according to the demand from the hospitals. This will be full.
The shelves look half empty, more than half empty.
Yeah. That's the main real problem today here in this country is the fact that we are not able to collect blood. We don't have enough stock of blood collected from voluntary donors or from blood collections.
Stocks of blood are low at Phnom Penh's National Blood Transfusion Centre. The day before my visit, they'd run out of supplies of blood group O, the most common blood type in Cambodia. Oscar Baraneche, blood safety expert at the World Health Organization, says it's getting harder to find people willing to donate blood, and the consequences are stark.
The tragedies are happening every day in all the hospitals, especially in the rural areas, where women who are dying after complicated delivery
children are dying because of dengue hemorrhagic fever, and there was not plasma for transfusion in district hospitals and provincial hospitals. Even in Phnom Penh, this is happening also in Phnom Penh when there is not enough blood. So this is more a daily happening tragedy, more than thinking about the possibility of a huge accident or a catastrophe.
At the capital's blood bank, as well as in 14 other provincial blood transfusion centres, carefully screen all donated blood. 20% of the total amount has to be discarded, as it's found to be infected with HIV, hepatitis B and C, or syphilis and malaria. Less than a fifth of the blood supplied comes from volunteer donors. The shortfall is supposed to be made up from family members of patients needing a transfusion. But as Dr. Nem Tork, acting director of the centre, explains, many are unwilling to donate blood and prefer to pay others to do so.
We can't clearly identify who the professional blood donors are because often they claim to be family donors, the group we call replacement donors. But when we test the blood, the degree of infection from them is much higher than for the voluntary blood donors. The reason that people are still scared of giving blood is that they often see sick people who don't have sufficient blood and are very weak. So they're afraid that if they give blood, they will also be sick and then not be able to make a living.
Twenty-two-year-old Keo Long says he's sold blood to middlemen four times so far. He's paid between $4 and $5 each time, more than he'd earn for a day's work, which is only seasonal. He says that after giving blood, he becomes weak, dizzy and pale. Nevertheless, he's willing to be paid for his services again. At this high school, staff from a mobile blood unit are targeting volunteer blood donors over the age of 17. It's part of efforts to recruit more low-risk regular blood donors, including monks at pagodas who make a vow of celibacy, as Dr. Lim Hoi explains.
The reason that we come to take the blood from the young people because now we find that most of them are not going to the dangerous place like infection like HIV, so they rarely come to have the sex with the taxi girl. And other thing, we have to go to Pagoda, is the best place that we rarely find HIV. We scare about HIV because the prevalence is very high at the moment.
19-year-old Long Chansadet is one of the new volunteers.
I've come to donate to help save the lives of patients who have lost blood.
Are you worried about giving blood? Some people in Cambodia do not like to give blood.
No. Before I was scared, but after the doctors here explained the process, I wasn't scared to give blood anymore.
Health officials say that unless they can establish a nationwide network of regular blood donors, there'll continue to be serious shortages of blood. In turn, that means it will be hard to eliminate professional blood sellers and ensure that most of the blood that is donated is infection-free.
And that was Caroline Gluck reporting from Phnom Penh. Now joining me in the studio is Robin Lustig, who's going to be chairing our regular weekly phone-in and discussion programme, Talking Point, after News Hour at the top of the hour. Robin, what have you got for us this week?
Well, in fact, Clive, we're going to be staying with that theme of AIDS today because we want to know what our listeners think should be done globally to tackle the problem. More than 80% of people who have AIDS are in Africa, and more than half of them are women. In the developed world, expensive drug treatments are helping to bring down death rates from AIDS. But for the rest of the world, is the answer more and better education? Or is it simply for men to change their sexual behaviour? According to the World Health Organization, AIDS in Africa is now the leading cause of death. In South Africa, fewer than half of the people living today can expect to reach the age of 60. We want to know what you think. Our lines are open. The number to call is 441-379-7444. That's 441-379-7444. Or you can send us emails. Our email address is talkingpoint@bbc.co.uk. And the programme begins in 35 minutes' time.
Thanks, Robin. Talking Point, right after News Hour.
With correspondents on the spot all around the world, News Hour is there when the big stories break.
There is, at least let us say, the hope today that the hand of history is at last lifting the burden of terror and violence and shaping a new and a peaceful future for the people of Northern Ireland.
News, comments and analysis from around the world.
Lots of other developing nations say they will reject the final declaration. Does that kill it, or can it be stitched up by the big blocks?
No, it can't, because WTO agreements have to go ahead by consensus. There's no real provision for majority voting, and if those other countries can't be persuaded somehow or other to come on board, then it's very difficult to see how it can go ahead.
News Hour, every day on the BBC World Service.
And now, here on News Hour, it's time for a summary of the very latest world news. Here's Nicola Davis.
The IRA says it has begun talks on giving up its weapons as part of the Northern Ireland peace process. It said a meeting had taken place between its representative and the commission that will oversee the dismantling of paramilitary arsenals. The IRA said further talks would take place. The next head of the World Trade Organization says that future international trade agreements must benefit developing nations as well as rich ones. And China has questioned whether the Americans are ready to make concessions in areas of trade where their vital interests are at stake. The Iranian authorities say a prominent advocate of reform, Abdullah Nouri, has lost his right to appeal against a 5-year prison sentence for political and religious offences. Mr. Nouri had already said he wouldn't appeal because he didn't accept the legality of his sentence. President Clinton's half-brother Roger has taken part in a jazz concert in the North Korean capital Pyongyang. Reports say he also met a close confidant of the country's leader, Kim Jong-il. Washington described the visit as a cultural exchange. United Nations officials say a convoy of more than 100 lorries loaded with food for famine relief is stranded by floods 200 kilometers south of the Somali capital Mogadishu. The convoy, organized by the World Food Programme, left Mogadishu 10 days ago with an escort of armored vehicles. In the Indian state of Orissa, which was hit by a severe cyclone 6 weeks ago, the chief minister is being replaced by his own governing Congress party after criticism of the way he handled the crisis. And the city of Bangkok has inaugurated a futuristic new system to help ease its notorious traffic jams. It's called the SkyTrain, an elevated electric railway that runs through some of the most congested parts of the Thai capital. It cost $1.5 billion. BBC World Service.
You're listening to News Hour with all the latest news, comment and analysis. I'm Clive Marden. Now, we'll go back to that news coming out of Northern Ireland. The IRA says it's begun talks on giving up its weapons as part of the Northern Ireland peace process. It said a meeting had taken place between its representative and the commission that's overseeing the dismantling of paramilitary arsenals. The IRA said further talks would take place. On the line now, live from Belfast, is the BBC's Chris West. Chris, the IRA, or rather Sinn Féin, had said the IRA would start dealing with General de Chastelain, the man overseeing decommissioning. They're now doing so. Starting talks, though, of course, no guarantee that they will actually give up any weapons at all.
No, but at least it's a start, I think. The statement which has been issued to the BBC by the IRA, as often is the case, it's more intriguing by what it leaves out than what it puts in. For example, it doesn't say who the representative is, it doesn't say where the meeting took place, it doesn't say when the meeting took place. But at least it says that something has happened, and it goes on to say it anticipates that further meetings will take place. There's been one report here today that the representative appointed by the IRA is a man called Porrick Wilson. He is the commander of the IRA inside the Maze prison. He's currently serving a 24-year sentence, but he's due to be released within a very, very few weeks. Now, if it indeed it is him, we certainly don't know that. The Northern Ireland office here, the government says that Wilson, in fact, hasn't left the Maze prison since last Thursday when the IRA did announce it was appointing this representative. So we don't know who it is. We don't know where the meeting took place, but we do know that something has happened.
From the Ulster Unionist leader David Trimble's point of view, Chris, it's what he needed to hear, isn't it? It's the sort of start of the process to allow the doubters within his own party to take a little heart, to have a little confidence that it might be okay.
This will certainly come as a huge boost to the Yes camp, if you like. David Trimble was badgering his own people to trust the IRA, trust Sinn Féin, which of course is anathema to Ulster Unionists, and this actually is the proof of the pudding, if you like. If it indeed has happened, it's a start. We don't know what they've been talking about, but at least David Trimble can turn round to the doubting Thomases in his party and say, look, something is moving. They, of course, will say, well, where's the beef? We've not seen a single ounce of Semtex. We haven't seen a single six-shooter handed over. So until that happens, we won't believe it. But at least it's a start.
But let us get this straight, Chris. There are plenty of people within the IRA, and there are plenty of dissident groups about now who have got no intention and do not want to give up any weapons at all.
That's true. The continuity IRA, the so-called real IRA, there will be many dissidents splintering off as time goes by from the provisional IRA itself. But the point is, if the main body of the IRA goes along with the decommissioning, if the main body of the IRA goes along with the present atmosphere, it'll marginalise these splinter groups. And certainly in a society like Northern Ireland and in the Irish Republic, these people need the support of the communities to exist, to be able to hide, to put their weapons aside, to conceal their weapons rather. And certainly if they don't have that, if the IRA makes it unfashionable, if you like, among Republicans to harbour the gunmen, then it certainly will go in the way that the Unionists and the majority of people in the North.
Tune in, 欢迎你。